Hi, this is Tamson Granger.
And this is Dan Avuhoff.
With Tamson and Dan, read the paper. It's Sunday, March 4th, 2018.
And we are in Richmond.
On location.
On location, Richmond, Virginia. Here for the weekend celebrating Ms. Granger's birthday. And as we were wont to do, we celebrated in Richmond at the home of David and Cynthia Gompert, who were gracious enough to host us last year and participate in the podcast. And I will say, they may not realize it, one of the most popular podcasts we've ever had. David's nodding. But
how many
not
listeners? Seven?
No, actually quite a number of listeners. Yeah. Okay. I would say in the scores. And so in any event, we have them back because they're so popular. They were kind enough to take some time and make us a rather elaborate breakfast. And we have a bunch of stories to talk about. Drawn not only from our normal stalwarts, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, but also from the local Richmond paper, which always
the Richmond Dispatch.
The Richmond Dispatch, which covers stories which we don't really catch always in New York, much to our detriment. And we begin with a story that brings together the expertise of everyone around this table in kind of a unique way. It has to do, in the first instance, with Oriental rugs. A seemingly innocent article about Oriental rugs in the New York Times this week, talking about what's in style and what's out of style, have tastes have shifted over the years. And then buried in the middle of this article is some discussion, believe it or not, of Paul Manafort, the ex-campaign manager of Donald Trump, who's being indicted and has his legal problems in Washington, D.C. And you're saying, what's the connection between Paul Manafort and Oriental rugs? And the connection is this, that apparently in response to accusations of money laundering, Paul Manafort's lawyers have put forth a defense that a lot of the money is accounted for by his expenditures for Oriental rugs that he bought.
Big investments in Oriental rugs.
That he bought a total of something like $930,000 of Oriental rugs. For his own use in Alexandria, Virginia.
And so you're saying, bingo. You're looking around the Gompert's house.
Well, wait,
you know, all these
wait,
Oriental
we have to
rugs,
tell people first.
And you're saying that everybody does this?
Well, we have to pause a second. People don't know David and Cynthia Gompert lived for many years in Alexandria, Virginia. So we had to rush right down and consult them.
So we're saying, bingo, Alexandria, right, Oriental rugs.
The Gompert's. I think we need to weigh in here.
Okay.
We do have a lot of Oriental rugs, yeah. Probably 30. And I think we have fairly good taste in Oriental rugs and the means to purchase good ones. But there's no way we could, in our lifetime, buy $900,000 in Oriental rugs.
In Alexandria.
In Alexandria.
In the shop.
Well, here's the shop. In fact, we've been to that shop.
Well, we should mention it. The article mentions that they determined it's the J&J Oriental Rug Shop in Alexandria, Virginia, which you actually know.
Yes, and so they're having a blowout clearance sale. But our average price per Oriental rug in this house is $600. So you'd have to purchase, well, you do the math.
You have to purchase $1,000.
All fairness, we're not saying you're into money laundering, but you know the J&J shop well enough to say that you doubt could spend
We doubt that they could spend that much. And now, as to whether an Oriental drug dealer would be tempted to get into money laundering, I think
the point is that the Times only can touch on the surface of this article. They're speculating that this may not be a strong defense, and they quote a couple of people who question whether you can spend that kind of money at the J&J Oriental Rug Shop in Alexandria, Virginia. But what I'm hearing from you,
we're not questioning.
If I'm hearing it correctly, you're saying for a fact that
cannot
happen.
It cannot happen.
It cannot happen. You've heard it here first.
Well, not unless he bought 900 Oriental rugs.
About 1,000, maybe 1,200.
Maybe 1,200.
Which would make him, he has other problems, really, if he bought 1,200 Oriental.
So this evidently is some sort of a lie.
Crack the case.
It sounds amazing. Cynthia.
Well, I'm going to say it said with 8 transactions from 2008 to 2010. And if he bought that many rugs, he would have to be in the fashion of layering Oriental rugs.
Yeah, like maybe 20 or 30 for each square foot.
So we know.
Because his house, is not big enough for all of this.
All right.
Yankee Stadium is not big enough.
Well, you see, this is why it's so great to be with the conference, because David brings his political expertise, and of course, Cindy with her rug expertise. And I think you've nailed this down.
No, but hold on, Dan. You bring a lot of legal expertise to this, and that, I think, is where this story has its greatest significance.
No.
Because I think we've caught him in a lie.
I think the papers seem to be making a falsehood. I agree with you. Yeah. I agree with you, and I think that is meaningful.
I need to just point out one thing. It did say that generally when someone goes into a rug store and they're looking maybe for a particular rug, and maybe that rug store doesn't have it, that they go out to other rug dealers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right? So you're saying J&J could have ordered the expensive rugs.
They could have, but according to this article, none of the other rug stores heard from them.
All right. So they're just digging, burying themselves, digging their grave.
But here's my question. Are Oriental rugs in or out at the moment? What does the article mention?
Cindy, tell us. We have it in the paper.
No, I don't think that they are right now.
They're not in?
No, they're not in right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a certain element of society, for instance, the Gomperts, that like Oriental rugs. And so we always buy them, but there are the people that are into the more modern rugs. They're handmade, et cetera. So,
well, that's just more... More bad
question.
News for Paul Manafort.
Yes, it is.
I leave you with this question, Dan.
Yeah.
Do you think Robert Mueller is aware of what we've determined as a fact?
I suspect not. I don't know what he has on the floor.
Right.
Or what kind
so
of
Mr. Inter- Mueller, if
what
you
kind
want
of intercepts?
Info,
I'm sure we'll get a call soon.
Give a call.
All right.
Office.
So then, of course, we'll switch to the next story, which is about baseball. Mr. Gompert.
Yeah. Well, this article from the New York Times. Sports section, Sunday sports section, caught my eye because it's about triples. And I've always liked the triple. Perhaps my favorite line about the triple is Joe Garagiola, who said, described Willie Mays' glove as the place where triples go to die.
Right, that's true.
That's a good quote.
Anyway, the problem, and the triple is very exciting. It usually ends in some sort of a climactic slide, tag, and it's unpredictable. There's a certain elegance to it because it's a long, the balls hit long, the runner's fast, and so on. So it's a wonderful aspect of baseball, but sad to say, as the article details, it has gone into a, let's call it a slide.
Oh!
And so the question is why. It accounts for the decline in the triple, mainly because of the growth in home run production. So I went back and looked at some of the statistics.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Well, let me first explain why a home run and a triple are related. The smaller the ballpark, the more the home runs, the fewer the triples.
Okay.
In fact, most players say, why should I go for a triple when if I hit it 3 feet further, I get a home run?
So players can do that? They can say, I can hit it 3 feet farther?
No, but if you are on base...
Yeah.
Okay, and the next guy up could well hit a home run. What does it matter whether you're on third base or second base? Right?
Give us your statistical analysis.
All right, so the analysis of the Times article is that it's because ballparks are smaller and home runs are more plentiful. Okay?
Okay, what say you?
I say it's much more complicated than that. First of all, outfielders have much better for rowing arms, just by the improvement over the ages in the physicality and athleticism of outfielders and other athletes. Second, outfielders are faster, so they can close the gaps, so balls can't get through
and turn into
triple. Okay. But also, and this is not in the article, but it's a little deeper, because outfielders are so fast, they play back farther because they're so good at running in on the ball, they can play back into what used to be triples country. All right?
I
just want to close this out by saying that what the article misses is that the number of triples hasn't really declined that much.
Right.
It's the number of home runs that have grown so much that it's taken a toll in the elegant triple.
Look, I don't disagree with too much of that, except I think if you think that all the outfielders are fast now, and they're all better fielders. You haven't been watching the Mets for the last few years. I don't know what game you're watching. I don't know if that's necessarily the truth. But in any event, it really goes to a bigger problem in baseball, quite honestly. I like the triple too, but you're still not going to see a lot of them. The question is, how are you going to get more base runners in baseball? And what you have, and what's really hurting the game in terms of the attractiveness, is it's a home run or strikeout situation. And what makes the game much more exciting is having people on base, because there's tension about holding them, tension about how they might advance, close plays as they advance to the bases. That's what baseball needs, and that's what this is symptomatic.
I think that's absolutely right. And there's
so we need more triples.
We need more singles and doubles also.
Singles and doubles.
Yeah.
That's what you need.
All right.
And I don't know what the solution is.
But there's another facet of this that I think touches on your point, and that is that baseball doesn't have the same sort of go-go, you know, gritty, Willie Mays, Pete Rose attitude. These players don't play with an attitude.
Right.
Few of them do, but fewer do. Mm-hmm. And it takes an attitude to round second base where you know you're in.
Now, the guys who
and
do
head
it,
for third.
Well, the guys who do it are not the superstars. The guys who do it are the grittier, lesser players, the Dustin Pedroias, the guys who are saying to myself, I'm going to make something happen here. And that's not the way the superstars play. They have too much at stake. They're getting paid $25 million a year. They're not looking to turn an angle.
The New York Yankees hit 110 triples in 1930.
Yeah.
And the average number of triples hit by a team today, 20.
All right.
There you go.
There we go. All right, Tamsin, on Vermeer and Picasso and artistic detective work.
Yes, well, there's a big excitement in The Hague at the moment because they're about to...
you mean Den Haag?
Den Haag. You know, of course the Gompers have lived in The Hague.
That goes without saying.
So this is all Gompert all the time.
And they had nice oriental rugs when they were there.
And at the Moritz Royal Picture Gallery, we have the famous painting by Johannes Vermeer of the girl with the pearl earring, which was not really very famous until the 1995 exhibition at the National Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And then people started going crazy about it. There was a book, there was a movie, you know, speculating about it.
He wasn't particularly famous until then.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't. He was, and his stature or his popularity, at least amongst, you know, the average...
folks like us.
Yeah. The average bear has grown dramatically since that 1995 exhibition. Anyway, they're going to do some new investigation of the picture itself, because although it's been looked at before with various technological methodologies, those are old time now. In 1994, they were using things like X-radiography, UV photography, infrared photography, and also they used to take little samples of the paint itself on the picture, like core samples, and teeny, teeny, weeny, but then they could analyze chemically the makeup of the different layers of pigment, etc., to analyze that. You don't need to do that anymore. The methodologies they use now are non-invasive and yet will provide terabytes of info. And the kind of things they do use now, fiber optic spectroscopy, macro X-ray powder diffraction, optical coherence tomography. These are methodologies that were actually developed for manufacturing, geology, medicine, and now they're being applied to art.
For the purpose of finding out what, though? What are they looking for?
Finding out how it was painted. You know, we can see there are different layers of these different paintings.
Yeah, but here's this is what... threw me off when I read the article and even listening to you. What is it about Vermeer in particular? What is it about that painting that is so significant that they want to do this sort of really deep analysis? It mean what made Vermeer famous, at least of late, was light, his treatment of light, and the almost, the brilliant way in which he captured light in his figures. Is that what it's about?
Interior light. No.
Well, what are they
because
looking
for? Because
we're...
They're, back to no. This is all about publicity. This is well-known...
It's a well-known painting.
Beloved.
It's no more complicated than that.
You know, painting... When this was at the Frick a couple years ago, There were lines at the Frick. There were lines at the gift shop at the Frick. You know? No. When has there ever been that? So I think this is just a way. The fun thing about this is that it will, all of this examination will be done in the gallery.
Yeah.
They're putting up glass, you know, a glass enclosure.
Well, this begs another question.
People can see it happen. Yeah. And it's just, it's publicity.
It's what's popular.
And they're also using these same methodologies on Picasso paintings and Picasso bronzes.
Okay.
Right. So these methodologies are being used everywhere.
Now
this is just clearly an opportunity for the Moritz House to be on the front page.
Because what do you learn? What do you learn from this kind of?
You can learn many, many things. You can learn how it was painted.
But not why you like it so much.
No.
Well, now you've all seen the movie.
But let me finish one thing. The fun thing about doing this also with the bronzes of Picasso is that they can actually use, as I said, some of these things were developed for geological purposes. So they are able to analyze the mineral makeup of these bronzes and actually trace where the bronzes were cast in and around Paris, because they can identify this bronze was used by this foundry and this by that. So that's more information and interesting information. It's again just more and more detailed information about the methodology.
This begs a question of whether the others here have seen Tim's Vermeer, in which a scientist who never painted anything in his life analyzes, who was struck by almost the impossibility of Vermeer capturing light the way he did.
Mm-hmm.
And so he comes up with various schemes that Vermeer might have used, with mirrors,
with camera obscura.
But he came up with an answer that he applied and painted. He replicated a Vermeer with fantastic fidelity using this particular method.
Right.
It's a great flick.
Right.
Tim Vermeer. Okay.
I just want to mention one. I'm sorry. I've seen Vermeer's analyzed. It's a little bit different than this, where they actually were able to look into the painting and see that there had been another figure in a spot.
And this is raised in the Picasso article as well.
Right.
Okay. So these kinds of, it's not unusual for artists to reuse canvases.
Right.
Okay. And over time, the pigments may bleed through or whatever.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so these kind of analyses are giving us more information about that. And also about alterations the artist, like Picasso, may have made, changing the way an arm is angled, doing it over and over and over again.
There was a French artist who was famous for doing interior paintings. People ran a table with a bright light on the table, George Latour, and they discovered, not through this latest technology, but with earlier methods, they discovered that he, in all of his paintings, he painted the entire room and then painted over it.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that.
George Latour.
And then from the Richmond Dispatch.
Richmond Times Dispatch.
Sorry.
Okay. A little correction.
A lot of us would like to dispatch
a little tidbit about some people who went to a funeral in a church in Louisa County. And because they are into extreme churching, which seems to be, if you go to a church, you then go through every nook and cranny. Not like our methodology of just running in, looking at the high altar and the nave, and then running out. These people go into every nook and cranny, and by George, they found a print of Raphael's Sistine Madonna
in Louisa County?
Yes. Yes, a print of it.
Oh, yes.
And you say, well, there are prints all over. Always run into prints. But this is a print specifically done many, many years ago.
Well, obviously we should subject it to the kind of analysis they're doing on the girl with the pearl earring.
It doesn't need to be, actually. It's a different kind of methodology. But anyway, it is probably one of the prints done by Frederick Mueller. I think in the 18th century, they only know of six of these. The Met has one. And so even though this is, shall we say, just a print, yeah. it's a reasonably valuable print. And it's another one of those fun situations of, you know, a kind of masterpiece hiding in plain sight. And suddenly this little church in Louisa County has quite an item on its hands.
The beauty of it is churches are struggling so much to try to get funding. They could sell that thing.
Yeah. Well, that's what I hope they do.
I do too.
I mean, you'd like to think
they will.
Okay, so tonight is the Oscars. And rather than speculate on the winners, although people are welcome to do that, one thing that struck me when I saw the journal this weekend is the thought that very few people actually see the most nominated films, or the films that are nominated for the highest awards. The example being, last year Moonlight had a total gross of $29 million, which is kind of a Lilliputian in this business. And if you look at the likely winners this year, maybe the two favorites for Best Picture are Shape of Water and Three Billboards. Shape of Water was the 50th, that's 50. Highest box office gross in domestic U.S. and Three Billboards was 55. So,
which shocks me.
Yeah.
Because on this podcast, we have heavily endorsed both films.
That's right.
And yet, no one's going to see
I think the answer.
I'm sure you have this fact at your fingertips.
Yeah.
Of the nominated films, which had the greatest
Dunkirk
viewership? And Dunkirk?
Yeah, really? Dunkirk.
Get many more second. People saw it, and how much did it gross?
Oh, I have this figure somewhere, but it's not an amazing amount. It's a reasonable amount.
And it was
amount.
Also the least, in my view, the least good film.
But anyway, the point is,
what's really a question. You say, why is it that the case? Now, you can easily say, well, there's no reason why the pictures that are nominated or likely to win Best Picture are going to be the most popular and have the most box office. I think that's a fair point, except it hasn't always been that way. And if you look back in some in the past, there's some obvious contradiction to that. Going back, you had Lord of the Rings, which is very popular at $565 million gross. You had Titanic, which won, you know, $1.2 billion. But even films that weren't epics, Forrest Gump, $720 million.
So things that were Best Picture, everybody went to
okay,
see.
Yeah, but let me give you the two examples that are most striking. They're not even the ones I mentioned, because those are kind of in between. Kramer v. Kramer, in 1979, I believe, grossed, and this is putting it into the dollars of today, $400 million. Rain Man, in 1988, was not only Best Picture, but was the highest grossing movie in the United States.
What were they competing
with? Well, let's get to that in just a second. But, I mean, just so people know, I mean, not everyone knows Kramer v. Kramer. Or Rain Man. They're both Dustin Hoffman movies. Kramer v. Kramer is about
Kramer versus Kramer,
is about his divorce from Meryl Streep and how he decides to take the lead in raising the child. It's not exactly, you know, space adventure. And Rain Man is in which Dustin Hoffman is playing an autistic person. His brother is
Tom Cruise.
And Tom Cruise has helped guiding him through the difficulties you'd expect them to have, and it's their relationship. That's the highest grossing movie in 1988. Think about the movie. Think about Tom Cruise's career, all right? Tom Cruise in 1988 is making movies and becoming a movie star based on movies where he's Dustin Hoffman's brother. Tom Cruise today, even though he's, I don't know, 70 years old, however old he is, 55, 60, mm-hmm. makes a living by doing Mission Impossible movies, which doesn't make any sense. Something has shifted in the culture.
They're probably
fundamentally
grossing a good deal.
They are grossing a good deal, but Tom Cruise can't play Dustin Hoffman's brother anymore. No one's going to that movie. Right. Okay? So these somewhat quieter movies, which are on the scene, or they're straight to video, or they're indie films, whatever they are now, they exist, but they don't have the kind of hold they had on the public then. They're
so
not
there's
the
a gap now
movie.
Between tastes of the great unwashed public and the tastes of the voters within the, what is it, the Academy.
I look at it
right?
a different way.
Whereas it used to be that those were closer.
Yeah, or the way I would put it is somehow movies like Rain Man were popular in 1988. Really popular. Movies like Kramer vs. Kramer were popular. And if you ask yourself, would those movies, if they were released today, you know, modernized to some degree, would they be popular? The answer is almost certainly
What's
no.
What's the competition?
That could be, but I'm not sure.
What about movie-going habits? Would it, are people seeing these movies now on the small screen?
That's true.
On their computer, on their phone, or whatever. But, and they're just not going to the theater, so we're not going to see.
First of all, I don't think people would be watching Kramer versus Kramer on the phone. I don't know. I will say this. The stat I have from this article is that the average person goes to the movies 4 times a year.
Really?
Right? And that actually, if you think about it, that pulls down not only the receipts you'd have for the kind of Dustin Hoffman movie I'm talking about, but also for the big blockbusters. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so a lot of those movies, the big blockbusters, are suffering at least as much as the quieter movies from people seeing it on DVD or Blu-ray or whatever. Yeah. So I don't think that explains the comparison so much.
It has to do with how discriminating the moviegoers are.
Yeah.
Because by today's standards, only a discriminating moviegoer would go to Rain Man or Kramer versus Kramer, which is a pretty sophisticated. Those are pretty sophisticated movies.
Well, something's changed. Something's changed in the culture. I take your point. There's a lot of economic forces. I haven't done a study, but to me, it's such a remarkable shift.
Yeah,
right.
Something in the culture.
What's your theory?
I don't have much of a theory, honestly. I really don't. I'm just more startled by it. I'm reluctant to say that the public is just not as interested in intellectual subjects.
What's the biggest earner today?
We don't know. All right. Well, this is an interesting subject, but we have no answers.
Yeah,
we're just raising it, right?
Yeah.
Well, okay. We don't even have a speculation.
Well, I think it is an interesting subject, and I think we don't know. Okay. But I think there's something afoot here, and it tells us more about society than it does about the movies.
Yeah.
Okay, so we were going to, you had a point about voting age, David.
I do. I mean, this isn't as important as the demise of the triple, but I'll cover it briefly. There's a op-ed piece in the Weekend Review, Sunday Times, and arguing that voting age should be reduced, federal election voting age should be reduced to 16.
And 16?
16. Now,
how did they come up with 16?
Well,
why are we stopping at 16?
I'll get to that.
Okay.
Okay. Now, the weakest part of the argument, which is also his principal argument, is that isn't it unfair that 16-year-olds are being mowed down in schools, mm-hmm. and yet they don't have the opportunity to vote on mm-hmm. politicians okay. that will institute gun control? Okay.
All right.
That's the weakest part, because you don't want to make policy on something this important, mm-hmm. you know, based on the emotions of the moment. The more interesting part of the article, I think, holds water, and that is that it's about cognitive development in human beings, and he distinguishes between cold cognition and hot cognition. Cold cognition is reasoning and decision making that occurs when you're in private,
mm-hmm.
when you're able to deliberate,
mm-hmm.
and you tend to make better decisions.
Okay.
Cold cognition capabilities are fully mature in human beings by the age of 16.
Really?
Yes. Then there is hot cognition. And hot cognition is when you're making a decision or attempting to reason under peer pressure, under some sort of excitement, urgency, mm-hmm. Passions are flaring,
mm-hmm.
and you're more susceptible to external influences. And hot cognition doesn't develop until much later. And 16-year-olds are extremely vulnerable to outside influences, including bad ones,
yeah.
at the age of 16. So
that's a problem.
So that's a problem.
Okay.
So
why are you in favor of giving 16-year-olds the vote?
Because voting is a very private, contemplative,
not necessarily. not if you put a 16-year-old in the booth, it's not going to be quite as contemplative.
The point is that the human brain
yeah.
that controls cognition operates as well with a 16-year-old as it does with an 18-year-old,
right.
let's say, under certain conditions,
I agree with that.
Calm conditions, such right. as exist in a voting booth.
Ooh, no,
okay,
but let me just jump in here. It's not a question of whether people are in a contemplative mood in the voting booth. The question is, what are the things that form people's point of view, and whether what circumstances really forge that thinking. And those that thinking could be actually forged as a result of an emotional experience, as a result of what you're calling
cognition. Well, that's true. That's true regardless of age.
It is, but I think what you've just told us is that the 16-year-olds are more prone to that kind of decision-making.
No, under those conditions, under hot cognition
I understand,
conditions.
But yeah. I mean, that's how people often make
up
their minds.
Be careful here, because next thing you know, you're going to be arguing that older people's vote should have heavier weights assigned to them than younger people.
Well, that wouldn't be the worst thing, but I wasn't. That's not where I'm going.
But look, some people will agree. Yeah. I do. Others will disagree. Evidently, my colleague here does. But it does raise an even more interesting question.
What's that?
Or a larger question of age thresholds for all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Okay, so what I thought I'd do in the 2 minutes remaining on this topic is sort of throw out some issues, rights and privileges, where you know there are age thresholds, and you tell me whether it should be 16 or higher.
Go ahead.
Purchasing alcohol.
Higher.
Purchasing cigarettes.
Higher.
Purchasing marijuana where marijuana purchase is legal.
Higher.
How high?
I don't know. But
I'm serious. Should it be maybe 21?
I don't know. I don't know what it is now, but I would say. But
well, these are 18. So
when you're
maybe
talking
they
about
should...
marijuana is illegal a lot of places. So it's
where
kind of
where it is legal?
Question.
Okay. Driving. 16 typically, but it's been bumped up to 18.
Yeah, we're in New York, it's kind of 18.
It's 18, yeah. Okay. Enlisting in the military?
I don't know. 18 sounds right.
Sounds right?
Yeah.
Okay. Running for office?
Oh, running for office, 18 is fine with me.
Okay. Marriage?
Marriage, I don't know. 18. Tapper, what do you think?
No comment.
No comment. Right.
Consensual sex?
Consensual sex, 35.
35. Purchasing a gun. Let me point out that the age for that allows you to purchase a gun is significantly lower than the age of being able to vote. Is that A, right? And is it
I don't
is
know
it reasonable?
That's true, but no.
It's true.
Yeah, I don't think people should purchase guns generally. So I'm
so we should raise the level.
Yes.
The age level for purchasing. So maybe if you go back to the idea if there's hot and cool circumstances, that would argue for raising the age at which teenagers or people should be able to buy guns.
Sure.
But lower, at least in my view, the voting age. At least it's a respectable argument.
It's okay. It's respectable, but I'm just basing it on the 16-year-olds I know, and it's kind of easy for me.
Okay, have we covered that?
I think we have. So
all right, let's move on to...
Unless you had any questions.
No. I'm good.
Cindy, you have the Taiwan story?
Yeah. It's just sort of a silly article about the toilet paper panic that is engulfing Taiwan.
That is the headline in the New York Times.
That is the headline.
Right.
Understated as usual.
And it says, readying for a price increase by clearing the shelves nationwide. And a few things wrong with this. It says that there's a rush on toilet paper was a top story for the local newspapers stacked next to the cash registers. Well. But, and the cost of toilet paper will go up soon. Have you prepared? Ask the techs at the top of a dedicated webpage of the online retailer PC Home.
That's right.
And then there was an ominous advertisement about, you know, basically you better shop now.
Yeah.
But then it
because there's a run on toilet paper?
Yeah.
Is this all a scam? Are they just pretending there's a run?
Well,
no,
but the pulp prices have gone.
I think it's a mainland communist plot.
No, but it says that this website was offering bulk deals on toilet paper by local and foreign brands. But according to the statement issued by the Ministry of Economic Affairs, the toilet paper producers say they have enough pulp used to make toilet paper. So I don't know what the big deal
is
about
it.
It is a scam.
It's an exaggeration. Yeah. But the fact of the matter
not only that, but for people in Taiwan, you know, the China is building up its military capabilities to launch a massive assault on Taiwan. Wouldn't that be of greater concern than the fact that there's a run on toilet paper?
That would cause me to think I want toilet paper in the house.
But actually, it does say that what has happened is it's caused more of the Taiwanese
To flee to the mainland?
To start using recycled.
There you go. That's all to
which
the good.
Which is a good point.
Except, you know, I think there's recycled and there's recycled.
It's an argument improved
I don't even want to know how you recycle toilet paper.
I don't either, but that's what they're doing.
So you have to use it twice? You shouldn't just...
Oh, my God.
No, it comes from the New York Times. And once the podcast is over, right. then the newspaper
the
can
newspaper,
be recycled.
Exactly.
And sent to Taiwan.
That's all right. All right. Moving right along. Back to the Richmond Times-Dispatch. A headline, Bobcat Caught in Car Grill Released into Wild. So apparently, a few months ago, a woman on her way to work in Richmond in her car from Gloucester County hit something along the way and just kept going. And when she got to Richmond and looked at the front of her car, there was a bobcat stuck in the grill work of her car. And so they got the EMTs or whatever to get the bobcat out of the grill, and it was nursed back to health. And now it's being released into the wild. But I had no idea that there were these kinds of risks to going to work in the area around Richmond.
Well, now you just need to be a little bit more aware of wherever you are.
Yeah, those bobcats. Well,
was it cited
they can
for,
be in the way.
Was it cited for jaywalking or anything? I mean, they just release it without questioning?
I don't know. Do they do that in Virginia? Do they cite wild animals?
No, they usually eat them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I don't know if it would be a happy ending if it was in New Jersey, Steve. You hit a bobcat in New Jersey, you're not nursing it back to health.
No.
I mean, that's just not happening. Yeah. I don't know what you're doing.
That's
about
a mean
it.
Thing to say, Dan.
I think there are very few bobcats I know have been nursed back to health.
Very few bobcats I know would want to be in New Jersey.
That's true, too. But they do have them in the northern part of Jersey, I understand. Yeah, they have coyotes, too. It's gotten
coyotes
crazy.
Are a real problem. Schools are closing down because coyotes have been... cited in the grounds. Not closing down, but they're not
all
having
the
outdoor recess.
All
in
the
New
more
Jersey?
Reason.
Coyotes
in New
are
Jersey?
Around.
Yes.
All the more reason why we should arm teachers.
That's true. That's probably
right.
a good idea.
That's hubris.
Yes, with rifles. The obituary, Cynthia Heimel, fearless sex columnist, passed away, according as described in the New York Times. Described as a fearlessly funny writer about men, feminism, female friendships, flirting, birth control, and lingerie. Now, there you go. This covers a wide swath. Published very much in The Village Voice and Playboy magazine. I don't know much about Cynthia Heimel. I'm sure she had her followers.
But her books sound great.
They do. I'll give you a couple of titles here, and I think we can all get on our Kindles and try to see if we can pick these up.
Perhaps at a discount.
No question about it. There was her biggest seller, of course, was Sex Tips for Girls. You know that one, Cindy. But that was followed by But Enough About You. And then we're just warming up with that. And then the main titles, If You Can't Live Without Me, Why Aren't You Dead Yet? That was in 1991. Get Your Tongue Out of My Mouth, I'm Kissing You Goodbye in 1993. And finally, the last of the trilogy, If You Leave Me, Can I Come Too, in 1995. So there's a literary career that had heretofore gone unrecognized, but I think we'll all be looking at our various sources to see if we can brush up on Cynthia Heimel, fearless sex columnist. That's pretty much it. I will say, you know, I keep thinking about that movie thing. I don't know what's going to win tonight, but I'm saying to myself, you know, it's not my favorite picture, but the Three Billboards movie, why aren't more people seeing that movie? I mean, that is a movie that they should be able to market.
Why haven't you seen Get Out?
Well, maybe we will. Maybe we will. If it wins Best Picture, we'll see it.
Listen, before we go off the air, you want to check out some of the rugs?
I have $900,000 to spend.
All right, the price has gone up.
I got the Subaru with the empty trunk. All right. Well,
on that note,
thanks
thank
again.
Thank you, David and Cynthia Gompert.
It's always a pleasure.
All right. This is Tamsin Granger.
And Dan Abuha.
See you a year from now, huh?
See you a year from now.
See you next year on Dan and Tamsin Read the Paper.
Thanks.